Hello and welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome and thank you for joining us for this third in a series of three CMO snacks titled Recent and Emerging Therapeutic Options for Alzheimer's Disease. This CMEO snack series is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk Inc. I'm Dr. Alex Attree. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Banner Research. I also direct the Banner Sun Health Research Institute. I'm a cognitive neurologist. And today I'm very happy to be joined by my distinguished colleague and friend, Dr. Sharon Cohen. Sharon, welcome. Can you
Hi,
tell us a
Alex.
little bit more about yourself?
Always great to be with you and discuss things happening in our field. I'm a behavioral neurologist. I'm the medical director of Toronto Memory Program, and I'm in the trenches diagnosing and treating patients as best I can, and also very involved in the drug development pipeline from the standpoint of a trial investigator. So yeah, that's been a big initiative of mine to move the pipeline forward as best I can.
Wonderful. And so today, to frame the discussion, let me first review our learning objectives. Our goal is that after this CME snack, you can identify sort of broadly the latest data on aspects of safety, efficacy, some mechanisms of action of current and emerging disease-modifying therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease. That includes drugs that target amyloid, others that don't. Things, for example, like GLP-1 receptor agonists. We'll talk about those. And without further ado, I'm going to ask Sharon, can you kind of tell us a little bit about what's going on in the field as far as particularly with the amyloid targeting therapies? What's been the regulatory pathway? What are the mechanisms of action? And kind of, give us a broad overview of the efficacy, safety, and other considerations for these drugs.
Oh, sure. Okay. Pleasure. So finally, after decades of many drugs not crossing the finish line, but many lessons learned, we are now starting to see some success with regulatory approval in some jurisdictions starting in June 2021 with aducanumab, an anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody, being the first drug to be approved under a conditional pathway, an accelerated approval pathway for treatment of early AD as a disease-slowing agent, disease-modifying agent. Now, the accelerated approval was based on amyloid lowering from two large phase three studies, one with a positive readout, one with a negative readout, controversy that followed. So that drug, aducanumab, is sadly being withdrawn from the market now. But as of January 2023, another anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody, lecanemab, which has a predilection for targeting protofibrillar amyloid, was granted accelerated approval by the FDA. And then in July 2023, full traditional approval based on the Clarity AD phase three confirmatory study. So we have a drug now in the US, in China, in Japan, with full approval to slow Alzheimer's disease at the early AD stage of disease. And lecanemab is under review by multiple other regulatory jurisdictions. At the same time, we have a third drug, donanemab, also an anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody, this time very specifically targeting plaque-bound amyloid. And it is under review in several regulatory jurisdictions. FDA notably is convening an advisory committee to discuss issues related to the dossier, and that advisory committee will be held June 10th of this year. So then we will have a better idea whether donanemab will be coming to the market. The expectation is that we will have a choice for patients of more than one anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody. So when you think about targeting amyloid, it's really interesting. You can think about targeting amyloid from the standpoint of preventing its production. Amyloid doesn't just arise de novo. It is cleaved from a large transmembrane protein, amyloid precursor protein, which lies across the cell membrane of neurons, and we have successive cleavage with different secretases that result in the A-beta monomers, which then start to aggregate. We get oligomers, protofibrils, A-beta fibrils, plaque. And some would say, and there's some debate, but many would say the oligomers and the protofibrils, so large soluble forms of amyloid, are actually the most toxic. And we know that oligomers can actually interfere with function at neuronal synapses. If you want to target this pathway, you've got multiple options. We have seen efforts to stop production that haven't worked out well, with BACE inhibitors coming out of the market several years ago because of off-target effects and some toxicity concerns. We've seen solanezumab, an important anti-amyloid antibody targeting monomers, not be successful. Monomers don't seem to be the best target. And then we have successes with lecanemab and with donanemab. So protofibrillar and plaque-bound amyloid seem to lead us to some clinical success, not just biomarker changes. You could also try to clear amyloid through the immune system by revving up the activity of microglia or other immune cells that would clear amyloid fragments. So lots of opportunities. And later, I hope we'll have time to talk about some intracellular approaches to shutting off amyloid production. But for now, the monoclonal antibodies that target aggregated amyloid appear to be where the successes are lying. And if we look at the lecanemab phase 3 data, the Clarity AD study, this was an 18-month randomized controlled trial, multinational trial. It was a large trial, 1,795 participants with early AD amyloid confirmation, either by CSF or PET, and a very mild population with a baseline CDR sum of boxes around 3, and 27% slowing on the primary outcome, cognitive and functional scale, the CDR sum of boxes, 27% less decline in the lecanemab-treated group compared with placebo. But notably, although we don't have time to go through all of the endpoints, all of the clinical endpoints, the key secondaries, showed highly statistically significant slowing of disease, with the functional scale, the ADCS-MCI-ADL, actually showing slowing of 37%. Then there were quality of life scales again, which showed significant benefit of the drug. And in terms of safety, the concern with this class of drug is largely related to ARIA-E and ARIA-H. And ARIA is a phenomenon whereby there is either swelling, as in ARIA-E or ARIA-H, spots of bleeding, often microbleeds, rarely macrobleeds. And this can occur spontaneously in Alzheimer's disease because of underlying CAA. However, with monoclonal antibodies targeting amyloid, we get an increased rate of ARIA-E and H. Fortunately, with the lecanemab program, the ARIA-E rate was relatively low, relatively compared with other antibody programs, 12.6%, and ARIA-H, 17.3%. But the important thing to really keep in mind is symptomatic ARIA was at the rate of 2.8% for ARIA-E and 0.7% for ARIA-H. So if it's not symptomatic, we know it's transient, it resolves radiographically, and it's really the symptomatic events that rarely can be severe, and we need to pay attention to and monitor for. There were no deaths in the lecanemab treated group. If we look at other AEs of importance thought to be or known to be related to lecanemab, apart from ARIA, infusion-related reactions occurred in about a quarter of the patients, so 26%, I believe it was. Often mild to moderate with the first dose, can be premedicated, but often doesn't recur, tends not to be a deal breaker with this treatment. However, infusion reactions were severe and serious in 1.2%, so we don't want to be overly casual. You do have to know about this. You do have to observe your patients in an infusion center and be mindful that this can happen. Apart from ARIA-E and infusion-related reactions, there are no other adverse events really ascribed to lecanemab itself. And for ARIA-E, we said the symptomatic rate is 2.8%. The serious ARIA-E is only 0.8%, so less than 1% have serious or severe ARIA-E. If we look at the Trailblazer ALS program, this is also a large phase 3 early AD study for 18 months, but a different trial design with patients who are confirmed to have amyloid in the brain, yes, but also at entry, they had to undergo tau PET imaging and would be admitted into the trial if they were amyloid positive and had intermediate or high levels of tau. So low tau individuals were not included in this trial. And there's some other distinguishing features. There's a titration scheme for donanemab, three doses of 700 milligrams monthly, and I didn't mention lecanemab is biweekly infusions, 10 milligrams per kilogram. Here you're titrating with donanemab after 3 months to 1,400 milligrams IV. We see on a secondary outcome, but an important secondary, the CDR sum of boxes, which allows us to compare, 29% disease slowing, and it said 27% with the CDR for the lecanemab program. Importantly, the Trailblazer ALS 2 cohort was stratified in terms of those with intermediate tau. That was the largest group, and a smaller group, but 500 patients or 550 patients with high tau. And when you combine the groups, you get that 29%. But we know that the intermediate tau group, the less severe group in terms of brain pathology, actually responded better. And the ARIA rates, ARIA-E, 24%, ARIA-H, 31.4%. And in the donanemab trial, within the core study, the double-blind portion, there were three deaths related to ARIA. And so this is important to know that rarely ARIA can be serious and there can be very severe consequences. In the lecanemab core program, there were no deaths related to ARIA.
Well, let me ask you, in the context of kind of pragmatics, how do clinicians discuss these potential sort of, how do they choose the right patients? What are the appropriate patients to choose? How do they describe the potential efficacy? Obviously, these are groups. What it may mean for the patients and expectations. How would they describe ARIA and the risk, for example, with APOE4 with the different drugs? What do you see as in this new era? You know, this the beginning. I would say the end of the beginning for AD. What are the sort of the barriers system-wise, et cetera, to get these rolled out?
Yeah, these are great questions. And I think we're all trying to get our heads around how best to get drugs that are helpful to people, to the people who deserve them. So I think we have to recognize that in this era of monoclonal anti-A-beta antibodies, we are dealing with a therapeutic that is not like anything we've had in our symptomatic therapy armamentarium for Alzheimer's disease. We need to identify patients early. We don't want to brush off the MCI stage and normalize it as just normal aging because then we may miss a treatment opportunity. So we have to be on the lookout for and take people seriously if they have mild symptoms. So that means, you know, clinicians need to up their game, either referring patients on who have memory complaints or doing some diagnostic workup themselves. And when you have someone with a clinical diagnosis of MCI thought to be due to AD or mild dementia, then for this kind of therapy, you need to confirm the biologic diagnosis. So you need either a spinal tap to look at CSF AD biomarkers, or you need a PET amyloid scan for diagnosis. And so that's challenging. There is cost coverage for much of this in the U.S., Not everywhere will there be. Not everybody can undergo an LP, but I think that it's more scalable and doable than PET scans, and less expensive. So I think different clinics are figuring out their pathways and what works, and it's always good to have options for patients. You also need not just to have the diagnostics in place to figure out eligibility, but baseline MRI to make sure there aren't risk factors that would raise the risk of ARIA too high. Things like excessive microbleeds on a baseline pretreatment scan, or recent infarct or previous macrohemorrhage. You need to have a patient who can undergo MRIs for monitoring as well. So someone with a pacemaker or severe claustrophobia, this may just not be the kind of therapy for them. So different from prescribing donepezil and, I'll see you in 6 months, you see you in 3 months. Here, the monitoring is important. The side effect profile is different than what most clinicians have dealt with before. A close relationship with a radiology facility that understands what you need in terms of ARIA reporting. We don't want to just say, there's some possible microbleeds. We want to know how many and where they are so we can correlate with possible symptoms. Because symptomatic ARIA has a different implication in terms of how you're going to manage your patient. There are many unanswered questions as well in terms of stopping criteria or maintenance dose, and our field will evolve. But I think having this foothold now, we are in a new era, as you say, and we will continue to learn and hopefully to help people.
So let's switch gears a little bit and think about, can you tell us a little bit more about all the other mechanisms are being, not all of them, but what other things other than primarily amyloids and plaque lowering investigational drugs are there? What broad categories? Can you tell us a little bit more about some of them?
Sure. It's so interesting that we put so much focus on anti-amyloid therapies, and we know that tau is also a bad actor in Alzheimer's disease. And so there has been an increasing focus on anti-tau approaches. But the drug development pipeline right now is really very rich in terms of multiple different ways of targeting this disease. And only about 30% of the drugs under development are targeting amyloid and tau. They're very important, but 70% of that drug development pipeline is represented by drugs with multiple other mechanisms of action. And near the top of the list, if not at the top, are drugs targeting the immune system and inflammation. And we know that inflammation is a part of Alzheimer's pathology. It's not how we define the disease in terms of a core biomarker, but it certainly contributes to the evolution of the pathobiology. And there's so many different ways that you can target inflammation. You could rev up the immune system so that you clear amyloid plaque better. You can tone down the immune system because the immune system is dysfunctional in Alzheimer's disease and may be secreting all kinds of cytokines and chemokines that damage the brain. Lots of different approaches, and it's really interesting to see where this will lead. And of course, the idea that the immune system is dysfunctional in Alzheimer's disease, but amyloid is also toxic, so maybe a combination of something that deals with the immune system and clears amyloid would be a really good combination. Other things going on in the pipeline have to do with neuroplasticity, neuroprotection, genetic approaches, trying to get an APOE4 to act more like an APOE2. I'm fascinated by that. I think the more we learn and understand this disease, the more we can apply what we've learned from the autosomal dominant Alzheimer's field to sporadic AD. So I think we're going to continue to have a very diverse pipeline.
Great. You mentioned some of the drugs that may even have multiple mechanisms of action, for example, and some of them are even repurposed. There are drugs that are, already approved for other indications. So, for example, can you give some examples? Maybe the GLP-1 receptor agonists. What's the rationale for those, and is there preclinical or any clinical data for that?
Native GLP-1 is a hormone. It is produced by L cells in the gut. And so, people have this sense that it's important for the GI tract and the liver and the pancreas, also for the heart and lungs and immune system. But interestingly, there are GLP-1 receptors in the brain. And in terms of the multiple effects of GLP-1 on the brain, there are several pathways by which this can be very beneficial, reducing oxidative stress, neuronal apoptosis, neurotoxicity, increasing integrity of the blood-brain barrier, reducing neuroinflammation, and all of these things add up to neuroprotection and protecting cognition and memory. And there are many lines of evidence that give support to the fact that incretin-based therapies or GLP-1 receptor agonists can be helpful in Alzheimer's disease. And this comes from preclinical studies in animals showing reduction in inflammation, reduced tau hyperphosphorylation, improved vascular health and memory. Clinical trials, both small trials in an Alzheimer's population, two studies there, one showing less decline in glucose metabolism in Alzheimer's disease in patients treated with GLP-1 agonist, and another Alzheimer's study showing less cognitive decline. And then the larger clinical trial data really comes from studies in type 2 diabetes and obesity where GLP-1 receptor agonists are approved. And there we see this very, very interesting phenomena, 53% lower risk of dementia in those with type 2 diabetes and some other benefits that we think would translate into better brain health. Real world studies, that's another source of encouragement for this class of drug. These are real world registries in different countries that also show significant reduction in dementia, all-cause dementia, and Alzheimer's disease in people on GLP-1 receptor agonists. So it's really exciting, and perhaps, Ali, you'll talk about the phase 3 program going on now, one of these GLP-1 receptor agonists.
Yeah, there's, as you mentioned, based on this, there's two large studies, EVOKE and EVOKE Plus, which are randomized control studies that investigate both the safety and efficacy of oral semaglutide. So this is given on plus standard of care in patients and participants who have early AD. So, MCI and mild dementia stages of Alzheimer's disease. And in one of the studies, individuals can even have some cerebrovascular disease on the MRI, and they're actually included in the study. And these are studies that are looking at the primary readout is at about 2 years, and looking to see if patients will have slower progression on the CDR sum of boxes. And there's a whole host of secondaries and biomarkers that are being studied, but basically parallel group. They come in, as you mentioned, in most of these studies, you have a titration phase. So they get titrated from 3 to 7 to 14 milligrams daily plus standard of care or placebo. And, in these studies, there's always an option if they're, generally with this class of drugs, initially when people come on, they may have some GI side effects. So they may feel full, for example, and that fullness may cause them to have a little bit of nausea, and rare, less likely they're going to have vomiting. Individuals who are, maybe heavier may actually experience some weight loss, but, most people, that's not the case. These are really important studies for us to think about different mechanisms that would be involving, like you said, neuroinflammation, vascular mechanisms, bioenergetics, not so much on the amyloid part, but maybe on how amyloid and tau and amyloid and neurodegeneration are being linked. And there are other studies in this space, for example, that are focusing with semaglutide more on the biomarkers on neuroinflammation, for example, and gene expression. So that's an option, I'm glad it's being done because we need multiple mechanisms. So in the remaining time that we have, which is a tremendous amount, but I want you to see if there's any other drugs that you wanted to mention, whether they're TKIs or you sort of touched on drugs that are little bit more, you know, looking at homozygous, for example, or any other drugs that you think, any agents that are targeting neuroinflammation, for example, in different ways.
Sure. I know we've only got a few minutes and there's so many exciting things to talk about. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors, that is one approach to targeting the immune system, and a phase three study with masitinib has been conducted, and we're waiting for a second phase three because the results were a little confusing with the existing phase three. The lower dose group had significant benefit in terms of cognition and daily function, but the higher dose didn't show that. So we need further confirmation. But then, nonetheless, for TKIs, the idea is that we are suppressing mast cells and microglia that are activated, I guess, active in Alzheimer's and are sort of dysfunctional and leading to the negative inflammatory component of the disease. So I think that's really the rationale for this approach to targeting inflammation. Other drugs, so thinking about our APOE4 carriers, we didn't have a chance to dwell on the fact that monoclonal antibodies targeting A beta tend to have more, show more ARIA in APOE4 carriers. That doesn't mean the E4 carriers don't obtain some benefit from the drug, but there is a higher risk of ARIA. If we look at a drug under development for APOE4 carriers, it's an oral drug, valiltramiprazate, which is a drug that stops monomers, A beta monomers, from becoming oligomers. And it does so really quite effectively, and we have phase two data that's very promising, biomarker data that shows marked normalization or reduction of p-tau181 in plasma and preservation of hippocampal volume and maintenance of cognition out to 1 year. So the APOLLO-E4 is a phase three study. It's a double-blind study now in people with APOE4-4, so APOE4 homozygous, with the CDR sum of boxes as the primary outcome measure. And we will see if catching these people at the early AD stage, we are able then to prevent monomers from becoming oligomers and protofibrils and plaque and protect the brain.
I think you've covered most of the mechanisms here. There are, 130, 40 drugs, some repurposed, looking at disease modifying, looking at symptoms, looking at neurobehavior. So the pipeline is still rich, but it's been a tough go, but I do think that because of our biomarkers, we're really accelerating things. And over the next 10 years, we're going to have to look at drugs in combination and use precision medicine more, even with these plaque-lowering drugs or others. I think identifying which individuals can potentially get more benefit, how can we mitigate the side effects. And in some ways, there's Alzheimer's diseases, not just one disease, because the disease itself, based on our own genetics and our resilience factors and vulnerabilities, can affect us differently. So we probably need combinations, I think. Any other thoughts before we summarize our SMART goals and finish up?
Yeah, I know. I think you summarized it well. We didn't talk about the drugs in early stage development, but there's some exciting things on the genetic front with gene silencing or small interfering RNA approaches to shutting off production intracellularly of amyloid precursor protein. That looks promising. Missense oligonucleotides shutting off production of tau. So I think we have learned from decades of failed drugs how to fine-tune our programs, what the right population is to test, and having biomarkers now to ensure target engagement and gauge success. We're moving faster. I'm convinced of that.
I agree. I agree. I think there's a rational basis for hope. All right. So we're going to summarize our SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. We hope that you'll take these points from the discussion, apply it both to your understanding and ultimately to your practices. So our goals were to identify both the efficacy and safety of emerging drugs, ones that have been approved, for example, recently, that are disease-modifying, mostly plaque-lowering, to look at the potential for disease-modifying agents in AD to be able to be translated, hopefully in the coming years, to clinical practice, multiple mechanisms affecting amyloid, neuroinflammation, energetics, tau, and others, and how these may be relevant to all to investigate in the future, and to our practices, hopefully, as we get more drugs that come through to that are approved. This was a CME stack as one of three part series. I hope you'll take advantage of the other two stacks in the series, where we'll discuss current and emerging best practices for timely screening and diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, also Alzheimer's disease, as well as neuroinflammatory pathological changes associated with AD and disease modifying drugs. And again, I really want to thank Dr. Sharon Cohen for this discussion, for expertly summarizing the ocean into a teacup here for us, and also you, the audience, for participating in this discussion and providing really care for our patients and families who need it. Thank you very much, and be well.